Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, my own Mr. Watson, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hi.
Hey, you know what I love best about Facebook?
What's that?
How easy it is for people to communicate with us from all over the world.
Oh, that's
Do you know what I hate most about Facebook?
What's that?
How many messages I get from people all around the world. And some of them get thrown. Did you know there's like two or three hidden folders?
Yeah.
On Facebook, if you've got to know how to look, and sometimes you notice it, sometimes you don't. And sometimes I miss some great letters and emails from our listeners, tipping us off to guests they think we should have on, tipping us off to stories, or, you know, asking for prayer and healing. So sometimes if we don't post these things, you know, we're pretty good at it. It's because if you're posting me on Facebook, sometimes you get thrown into the netherworld and it's hard to find me or connect because you're in one of two spam folders, because they've got like the secret spam folder, then they've got the double secret spam folder, Tim.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't understand the whole philosophy on this, but as I was digging through emails the other day, I stumbled upon the double secret probation folder, and I found an email from a lady 3 years ago.
No.
Saying, I have a friend who listens to your program and suggested that I might be a good True Crime Tuesday guest. And I was like, oh, gosh, what are the chances 3 years later this woman's A, going to even care enough to talk to us, or B, you know, that she's even using Facebook anymore.
Right.
So I click it. I send a message. Boom. She gets right back to me. She's willing to reexamine this case with us. So we have her on today with us. The book is called Lady in White, and there's a much longer title to it, but I'll butcher the names. So I figured I'll just let her introduce us to the characters involved. Our guest today is Denise, and I hope I say this right, Tanaka. Am I saying that properly?
Yes, thank you. Yes, you are.
Excellent. Very good. Well, thank you so much, Denise. And I'm sorry it's taken 3 years to get together. And for anybody out there that's listening to the show that wants to be a guest or wants to alert me to a guest, email me, dave@darknessradio.com, because I get those and I put them in folders, true crime folders, paranormal folders, all of those, so that I can find them and dig through a little bit easier. But here we almost missed an amazing guest and an amazing story. Denise, thank you again for the 3-year delay of me getting back to you, but you still being gracious enough to answer my email.
Yeah. Well, I want to first, you know, thank you for having me on your show, Dave, because, you know, I pretty much put it aside and went on with my life. And
wait a minute. Kind of you weren't so sitting there patiently for 3 years waiting for my phone call?
Oh, well, oh, should I say I was?
Yeah. That'd only help my ego. Well, you know, give us a little background. Tell us a little bit about you and why this book.
Right. Yeah. So I'm kind of an amateur historian and genealogist. And by day I work as a paralegal doing immigration. So I'm always interested in these kind of cross-cultural, you know, country things. So I discovered this case from a biography of silent film star Rudolph Valentino.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And so, like, in a very brief episode back before he was famous, when he was like a two-bit tango dancer in New York high society, he was acquainted with this woman who was this heiress from Chile, and she had married this, you know, popular real estate guy who was a former Yale football player, and she was very glamorous and all like that. So they parted, went their separate ways. He went to Hollywood. She had a kid with the football star. Yes, I realized no one had actually done any book about this. You know, there are books about Lizzie Borden or books about Jack the Ripper and all these things. But this was a sensational crime back in 1917. It knocked World War I off the front page of the headlines. When I looked at old newspapers, like, this was big, big news. It was all anybody was talking about for months.
This was kind of the OJ trial of its time then.
Yes, very much. It was, and with, unlike OJ, like, everybody knew she did it, but her trial was just covered in the papers every single day. What's going to happen? And it was very, very sensational. So I thought, well, if no one's done the book yet, I'll do it.
What a crazy story. Well, talk to us. Now, help me with her name. Blanca, I get. How do you say her last name?
Well, I'll give it my best shot to Errázuriz.
Okay, so Blanca.
I'm not sure if you roll the R's, but Errázuriz.
Errázuriz. I like that. What can you tell me about Blanca before her life with John?
She grew up in the capital of Chile, back in Valparaiso, where her mother was also an heiress, and they have a big estate down there, which today is an art museum. And so, she had all the money, she had all the wealthy upbringing, she went to the best schools in Paris, and she was really pretty young when John came down to Chile, and he was one of those foreign investors. They were developing the railroad that now goes from Valparaiso up through the Andes and into, Argentina, right? So they were part of the developers building that tunnel that goes through the mountains. And he was just, this handsome guy with the blue eyes, and he thought she was something special, and she thought he was something special, and he just swept her off her feet.
And there was this, so it was almost like a storybook romance. Now, my kids and I will watch some of these old movies, and they're astounded. Mm-hmm. They watch Hamilton, and Hamilton meets his wife, and within 2 weeks he's engaged and married. And, we watch a lot of old Cagney movies or Bogart movies, and they meet and they're in a whirlwind romance and married within a week or a month. Mm-hmm. They're like, Dad, why do they do that in these old movies? And I say, well, that's the way life worked back then. If you met somebody and it was a good connection, a lot of them got married quickly, and mm-hmm. and that was it. How long was Blanca with John from meeting till marriage?
I would have to go back and look exactly, but I think it was very brief. Like, he was down on the beach, and it was within a few months. I think they just got the mother's blessing, and a ring was on her finger, and they were sailing back into New York Harbor.
Well, he had an interesting pedigree.
She really was swept off her feet. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, he had an interesting pedigree, of course. Now, talk to us a little bit about John before all of this. What was he like? What do we know about his personality and his upbringing?
Right. Yeah, that I was amazed at how much I could discover, because he seems like a really outgoing, typical all-American guy. He was raised... his father was from New Orleans, but then they moved north to Pennsylvania, and he went to Yale, where he was really good at athletics. So he was a football star back before football was what it is today. And he learned from one of the guys who at Princeton, no, Yale, both Princeton and Yale both had football teams that they were developing from rugby. And so he was really athletic, got really good at it. He was in all the papers. He published a couple of books of how to be a quarterback. And everybody said, he was friendly. They liked him. He later on coached at University of Virginia. His team loved him. And so I just imagine he was this really friendly guy that you would just immediately have a rapport with.
They meet, they fall desperately in love, they're married. For how long a period of time are they together?
I would say about a year or two. They got married, I think, in 1914, and she pretty much right away had a baby. And then he went off to New York, and he was getting into real estate and doing all his wheeling and dealing, making money, while he left her kind of at home with the kid and his in-laws. And that's when she started to get into a bit of a depression. I think no one knew about postpartum depressions back then, but there are some of her personal letters to her friends and her maid where she just really sounds like she's on the edge of trying to cope with having the baby, being in a new country, being with the in-laws. All that stuff just, I think, started building up on her.
Yeah, postpartum depression. Do you believe that that plays a little bit? We don't have to give it all away right now, but do you believe that that plays a trigger to this? Or do you think it was just everything kind of woven together in this tempestuous tapestry?
Yeah, everything. I think that's when she started to really go downhill, and then the divorce didn't sit well with her. I wonder if she had this feeling of like, well, I'm Blanca Errázuriz, and I'm from this prestigious family. How dare you divorce me? And she was Catholic, too. So back then, you just don't get divorced.
Well, let's talk about that. So they're together, although separate, because of his career and what he's doing. How, you know, how soon, you said they were together a little over a year, maybe just under 2 years. Who decides to go for this divorce, and for what reason?
Right. I'm thinking it was him that sort of wheeled her into it, although she's the one who technically filed the papers and saying that he was unfaithful. There were rumors that he was hanging around with some Broadway dancer named Joan Sawyer, who had like a nightclub in New York. But, you know, you don't really know what was going on, whether he just wanted to get rid of her and talked her into filing the papers. I go into it a little bit in the book about how the laws in New York, the only reason you could file for divorce was for adultery. And so everyone would hire these models or dancers and stuff to say, oh, yeah, I was having an affair with him. And then, boom, boom, the judge would rubber stamp it.
And that was it. So that infidelity, do we know if any of those claims were actually true, or were they settling on something that the courts would allow for a divorce at that time?
Right. I'm tending to think it was the latter, because once the divorce went through, Joan Sawyer went her own way and went to Hollywood and made movies, and he just went his own way, and he settled for a really good custody deal. Like, he got Blanca to sign off on where his son was going to be educated, where he was going to do this. He was going to stay in the U.S. She could not take him back to Chile. Like, there were a whole list of conditions with the custody agreement after the divorce. So I think that also felt she was getting squeezed. Like, she couldn't even go back home unless she wanted to leave her son behind.
All right, so obviously that starts to create a lot of animosity towards one another. Is he trying to keep a low profile in this because of his level of celebrity and his business connections? Or you know, exactly how are they playing this out? Is it a public kind of dispute?
It's, well, a divorce was in the society pages of all the newspapers and lots of rumors. But afterwards, he got her a house on Long Island that was not far from, he bought a new house on Long Island. And so it was within like maybe 45 minutes by car between each other. And they could then share custody of the son back and forth. You know, some, this is your weekend, this is my weekend. And the son gets bounced back and forth between them.
Is there, you know, once the divorce is kind of settled and they're living these type of lives, is there a lot of aggression going on between them? Is there pressure from their families? What can you tell us about both of their lives?
I think she was living mostly very isolated. She was cut off from her family. So she was just living in the house in Long Island with her maid and maybe a chauffeur and getting money. But her family, they were still in Chile or in Europe. But John, you know, he kept having lots of real estate deals. He'd go back and forth to New York. He had his brother and other business partners. And so I think he was enjoying himself. Oh, and he was also involved in the election of Woodrow Wilson. He did some of the campaigning for him and organizing some of the college men.
So his life kind of,
Woodrow Wilson,
he gets to continue on and make a splash, and he gets to continue on and live kind of a normal life, where she is more isolated and alone. Does she begin seeing anybody?
No, not that I'm aware of.
All right, so she is totally in this isolation mode.
Mm-hmm. It's just her and her son.
What do we know about her personality during this time? Do friends or relatives or even maybe her workers start to notice a change in who she is?
All I can rely on is the testimony at the trial where her maid talked about her just being more frantic or more anxious whenever it was not her time to have her son. And so she would always be like, when is he coming home? When can I see my son again? Or being on the phone to Jack and saying, can I have him back early? And he would be, nope, it's my weekend. So just very uptight, very stressful, very, very anxious whenever her son was not around.
Now, how long total are they divorced before she makes this tragic choice?
I have to look up the days, but I think it wasn't very long. It was within 6 months, I think.
All right. So it's kind of a slow descent, but it's actually a very short period of time. And during that time, she's mm-hmm. kind of slipping into madness, as her employees say.
Right.
What is that snapping point for her? What do we know?
That, I think it was a combination of a terrible heat wave that summer. So it was in the first week of August of 1917. And I pulled up old newspapers that said that there was a heat wave where horses, pulling the horse and buggies, were just dropping dead in the street. It was humid. It was miserable. And that went on for like over a week. And I don't think she was enjoying that heat very much from coming from Chile, which down there, the weather is kind of like San Francisco. It's on the coast and there's ocean breezes. So I don't think she ever felt hot, humid, miserable weather like this before. And that and being away from her child. So there was that one night where her ex-husband asked for special permission to have the son over to his house because his father and brother were visiting. And she got anxious and called him on the phone and said, I've changed my mind. I want my son back. And he said, no. And she decided to drive over there on the spur of the moment. I mean, I guess a lot of her stuff sounds impulsive mm-hmm. or just, I don't think she really thought it through.
That's it's tragic, right? That there's just this kind of unwinding of somebody and mm-hmm. her need to try to control the one thing, which is her son, right? The one part she feels she has some power in this relationship.
Yes.
But, you know, to listen, I've got kids, you know, and have had custody irritations, I'll call them from time to time, but never to the level where mm-hmm. I thought, well, that's it. Somebody's got to die. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's kind of a pretty big leap, in concept. What do we know about her decision to do that? Did she go with the intent or did she carry it with in case there was problems? What do we know?
Yeah, that also, I don't know what was in her mind because she doesn't know what was in her mind. She went over there with her chauffeur, drove her. And when she got out of the car and walked up to the front of the porch, she was holding that little .38 revolver in her skirt, right? So clearly she meant to either threaten him or, I don't know, I don't think she meant to really shoot him. But when he came out on the porch and she said, can I have my son? And he said, no. She said just something kind of blinded her and she blacked out. And the gun just came up in her hand and she shot him.
So her concept was she just kind of checked out mentally. Something took over.
Yes.
Did she ever try to, you know, obviously we do a paranormal show on Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. Did she ever try to mm-hmm. blame the fact that there was a ghostly or possession or something that that was pushing her to do this?
Oh, no, I don't think she ever did that. She felt a pain in her head and blacked out.
Okay. Oh. And she shoots. And where does she hit him?
Dead in the chest. I mean, she was point blank, and she emptied all five slugs right into his chest.
Wow. So she was fully committed to mm-hmm. this murder. You know, it's weird. You hear about that dissociative behavior. And it sounds like that's what she had. I guess she knew what she wanted to do, but that break in sanity, if you will, that the humanistic mm-hmm. part of us that is tethered, when she made that decision right. to pull the trigger, it's like she separated in that moment and just could not consciously absorb what she was about to do. Shoots him five times. He, I'm guessing, drops dead immediately. Where does the story go from there?
Yeah. Well, he dropped dead. He wasn't immediately dead. It took him a little while to bleed to death, but she exhibited very peculiar behavior. She was, you know, calm. She was cool. She just, while he's laying there on the floor, she turns to the butler and goes, "Could you go get me my boy now?" And they were like, "No, we can't." So she just calmly walked outside and sat down and waited for the sheriff to come. And the sheriff said, "Are you Mrs. DeSalles?" And she goes, "Yes." And she goes, "Why did you shoot him?" "Because I wanted to have my boy. I shot him because he would not give my boy back."
So the men there, and nobody rushed her. Nobody tried to stop her. They just, once they saw the aftermath, went and phoned the police.
Right. I guess it happened all so quickly. Like, they didn't expect her to pull a gun and shoot. So, you know, they were all in shock just standing there. So the butler called the police, and his sister went upstairs and stayed with her son. So I don't think her son ever even saw what had happened.
Good God. And once the police are there, how do they respond to this? I mean, is it a violent ending for her, you know, or is she just reserved to the fact that she's going to jail?
Yeah, she just was very quiet and very polite, and they just put her in the car and took her to the jail, where she just sat very quietly, and they remarked on how calm and cool and quiet she was. Almost, I guess you say, either resigned to whatever her fate may be.
Sheesh. All right. Once she's taken into custody, I mean, it's an open and shut case. Why is there even a court case for this?
You would think, yeah. I mean, I got the indictment, and unfortunately, the court had a fire in 1981, so all the original transcripts are gone, and all I could rely on was the newspapers that the reporters went to court every single day. And I suppose the main reason was, should she be punished? Should she go to jail? And if you do that, then this little boy is without a mother.
So they're taking into account, that's so bizarre. They're taking into account, well, do we put her in jail for this murder? Because now this kid will have lost two parents.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Huh. That's just an interesting element to this to me, that it was like, well, we know she did it, but so they were almost looking to give her a reason out.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. You know, I never occurred to me, because that was the cornerstone of her defense, that when her lawyer showed up and that, yeah, he made the argument, if you send this poor, sweet, innocent woman who was, you know, the victim of a womanizing husband, and oh, she just loved her little boy, and the boy will be without a mother. And so that's when the trial got really strange. Like, everything turned upside down. So Jack, who was, you know, relatively popular, he was well known, he was a friendly real estate guy, all of a sudden they pulled out all these rumors and, oh, how he was womanizing and he was drinking and partying and he treated her so badly, that by the end of the trial, they had all the feminists and the suffragists were cheering her on. The jury had tears in their eyes. They were, oh, this poor, poor woman. And they pull out psychiatrists who talked about her, you know, mental state and her thyroid imbalances, and she just couldn't help herself.
Jeez.
It was very, very strange.
Yeah, it seems like it. You know, I mentioned the whole thing of, like, were they looking for a reason to get, you know, when I was in high school, I was driving with my girlfriend, and she had had her license for just, I think, a couple of weeks. And All of a sudden the cops, you know, this was at night, she was going to drop me off at home. The cops flip on their lights behind us, and she just breaks into tears. And the cop is, you know, he's talking to her. He's like, is everything okay? And she's like, yeah. And he goes, well, you know, you're going a little fast for back here. I'm sorry. She's crying. He goes, is there anything you need to tell me? And she's like, not picking up the cue. He's looking for any reason to let her go. And I'm like, He goes, all right, I'll be right back. And he takes the driver's license and heads back to the car. And I said, you stay in the car. I'm going to go talk to the cop. You just go along with whatever happens. And she goes, okay. So I walk back to the car, and the cop gets out and he goes, can I help you? And I said, yeah. Now, this was the 80s, folks. I don't encourage you ever to approach a police car. But, you know, I got out. I'm a teenage boy. I get out and I stop politely at the front of his car. He gets out. Can I help you? And I said, yeah. I said, you know, this is really all kind of my fault. We just broke up. She caught me cheating at a party we were at, and she's dropping me off, and she's just very emotional. And he goes, really? And I said, yeah. And he goes, you stay right here. And he goes over to her window and he knocks, and she rolls down the window, and he hands her back her license. And he goes, honey, you drive home. You can do better than this scumbag. And then he turns around, he points at me. He goes, you walk home. And I was like, oh, that's cold. So she didn't get her ticket. I had to walk in the freezing cold, and the cop went back to his car and left. And it was, but it was funny, because it was one of those moments where you could see they wanted to bend. The law wanted to bend to fit this moment. And although it's not murder, thankfully, it was, you know, one of those instances. That's why I said, I wonder if they were looking for a way to try to make sense of it, so that they obviously also, you just don't assume a woman is that kind of protagonist, that they're going to be the ones that would be cold-blooded and murder it, right? So I wonder if, You know, let's make sense of this. It had to be this. It had to be that he was abusive and horrible and whatever, in order for them to try to process how this was all going down.
Exactly. Yeah, and especially since she's this well-mannered, lovely young thing, and she comes from a fine family, you know, it just doesn't compute that she would do something so horrible like this without a good reason.
Right. All right. So how does the court case go? I mean, she's obviously winning over the suffragette movement, the women's movement. They're all kind of cheering her on. Is that putting some kind of political squeeze on the people in the courts, or are women at that point still not powerful enough to influence the law itself?
You know, I wonder if it might have had an influence on the jury, seeing all those women show up every day in the courtroom as the audience and just cheering her on. And also the times when they would allow her son to visit her in jail, and that would show up in the newspapers too, like, oh, this dear darling boy, and she loves him so much, and all those sentimental things that would affect the jury. And the jury back then was all men, so there were no women on the jury. There were all these middle-aged men who kind of could have seen her as like a daughter figure or a sweet, gentle young woman from how she appeared.
All right. Well, what is the eventual findings of the court?
Was complete exoneration. They declared her not guilty. And not even with temporary insanity, but just complete acquittal.
Now, it's important, too. I'm sorry if you mentioned this, but you've got this former football star, this very popular, powerful man laying on the porch, bleeding out of his Long Island home. And she just hands her empty gun to the sheriff. And what is the quote she gives? Isn't it, "I hope he dies"?
Yes. "I shot him because he would not let me have my boy. I hope he dies."
And they still found wiggle room to forgive.
Yeah.
But was there any corroboration that they could uncover about what a ne'er-do-well he really was? Or was that all just hearsay and kind of them throwing out the what-if factor?
Right. It was all entirely hearsay. They brought up the testimony from their divorce, where he was accused of philandering with that Broadway star. And that's pretty much it. And so even though his family came and testified of what a great guy he was, his own father, who was this really aged, feeble old man, put on a very pathetic show in court, which I thought he sat on the stand and he kind of cried out in a really sad, aged voice, like, "She shot my boy, my only son." And he had several sons who had died by then. So with Jack gone, he only had one son left. And he was heartbroken and feeble and had to be helped to walk in and out of court. But even that was not enough to sway the hearts of the jury.
She gets fully exonerated. How does that affect the town? How does that affect the people in that community at that point? Or is everybody on board that she was just this poor, put-upon, abused woman?
I think from what I can see in the papers, it was a celebration. You know, the reporters met her outside the courtroom. She was cheered. There was applause. It was like, you know, she's won a victory for justice kind of thing. And she was celebrated as a heroine.
That's, that is just so bizarre. So what is her life then like after this heinous murder? Is she kind of a celebrity because of this murder? Is she beloved? Does she find peace and happiness again? What do we know?
Well, from what I know, she took her son and went right back to Chile and went home and raised him down there. And she married again a diplomat and spent the rest of her life in the lovely gardens of Valparaiso. There's one rare photograph I have of her at a cocktail party where her son is kind of looking like something in a silent movie. And, you know, I don't know if she just drank and partied and enjoyed her life afterwards until then. It could be she was addicted to pills. And there's some stories that say in her final days that she was maybe haunted by hearing Jack's voice. I don't know. She would walk around her room going, "Jack, is that you?"
Really? So she would hear this voice. Did she ever discuss what he was telling her?
No, I got it secondhand from translating some accounts in Chile and the rumors about her down there, where they remembered her as, you know, very nice, lovely lady, but always kind of haunted by this, what she had done.
Wow. I wonder if she ever found peace with that at all. And once she's gone, I mean, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, I'm guessing, at that time, right? Especially if she moved away, it's this black mark, this smear in the area and on the families. But you find no proof for any of this. That's really kind of telling as well, that it's not just, you know, I mean, you're a woman telling this story, so it's not coming in at a slant of, "Oh no, she was poor and put upon." It was just how the system failed, possibly to really show, I guess I'm trying to say, you know, real justice served, but did it? You know, he'd already lost one parent, this child. Do they cause him to lose both? And he becomes a ward of the state and a problem, or where do they go with that? I guess what a weird time it must have been to have to examine a case like this and what decision you want to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was still a long time before our modern courtroom procedures. Like, it wasn't even common to have psychiatrists or anything in the courtroom. This trial sort of started that, to have expert testimony come in and talk about her mental state and how she loved her boy and testify that way. That was all brand new.
Yeesh. And that's it. Did the family ever speak out about it? Did they, you know, was there ever a public outcry that justice may not have been meted out the way it should have been? Or was it like, you know, let's just put this all behind us and be done?
Yeah, they did sadly just kind of fade back away. And Jack's father passed away in Christmas after her acquittal in November. So it was just barely a month after she was set free that his father died of a broken heart, I suppose.
Oh, that's tragic.
And the family just moved on.
What do we know of their son? Whatever happened to him?
Him? I tried to research and contacted a few people down in Chile and, you know, their historical society. And from what I know, he lived the life of a happy single bachelor down there on the golf courses and the polo fields. And he never married. He never had kids of his own. And one day just dropped dead of a heart attack.
Really? So it's just tragedy befalling this family all the way around. How horrific. Wow.
Yeah, there was just no happy endings anywhere.
As you're digging through these old papers and accounts, what really surprised you about this case?
I think what surprised me was the level of emotion versus logic. As you said, like, the newspapers and the courts and the jury and everybody just seemed to be swept up in the gossip and the emotion and, oh, she loves her son. But I was like, wait a minute, she shot a guy. How could they just let her get away with that? And it's not like Lizzie Borden where, you know, if they could have proved she did it, I'm sure she would have gone to jail. But like, we have proof. So right. Why was there no consequences for this woman?
Did you do any historical reference to look at other cases similar to that at that time? Was it really that difficult or I guess not difficult, but was maybe at that par for the course? Were women kind of allowed a certain level of leeway in cases like this at that time? Because I got to guess, reading historical accounts, men were a lot quicker to raise a hand. Men were more abusive openly, and it was almost like what are you letting your wife talk to you like that? Give her a hand, right? And that's kind of just our culture at that point.
Right.
So I'm curious, you know, what did you find out about that?
I think there was one other case in Long Island similar just the year before her, where a woman was accused of shooting the mistress of her husband through a window. And again, you know, she was a wealthy woman. She's in high society. And she was, I think whatever her trial was, they got her off because no one witnessed her doing it. And so it was all circumstantial evidence. And she also walked free. And I said, how could they possibly accuse this society woman, this upper crust polite woman, of doing this horrible thing?
Wow. So women could get away with murder at that point, because again, I think that's what really, from reading all the transcripts on the Lizzie Borden case, even though there was probably enough evidence to, you know, in today's courts to really put upon her that she was the murderer, I think it was just hard for men to believe that any woman could be that strong and powerful to have committed the kind of heinous crimes that she did.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And especially women who are the wealthy ones or the pretty ones or the of gentle society, you would think of the women in the Wild West, like Calamity Jane or something like that. Oh, yeah, maybe she could shoot a guy, but certainly not this delicate lady who's so polite and of good family. She could never do something like that, you would think.
Yeah, it would seem. Wow. Well, what an amazing story. Thank you for finding this lost treasure, something that, might have gone forgotten. It is strange how you can be pointed from one story to another. Here you're, Rudolph Valentino is kind of the weird latchkey to this entire story, right? And mm-hmm. and bring you yes. in this way. Do you think there are a lot of other crimes that kind of fall in this vein, horrific things that we just knew nothing about that still exist out there? And are you digging more out to write about?
Oh, yeah, I would love to discover more. I know from just browsing through old newspapers on the Library of Congress website or something like that, you can discover all sorts of peculiar things that happened. So, yeah, I'm sure maybe I'll discover another one in the near future.
Just goes to show you, no matter what time period we live in, the propensity for what we can do to one another is always shocking and really shouldn't be all these years later, right? I mean, people are still cold-hearted, calculating, and when it comes to getting their way, we'll stop at nothing, really.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, and Denise, women can be just as violent as men.
Right. Yeah, that's something everybody needs to pay attention to. And I'm glad you said that as a woman, not me, or I'd be getting hate mail right now. Denise, thank you so much for coming on to share this story with us. We've got a link up for this book in today's program guide. So all you have to do is click on the link. It'll take you right to our Amazon shop where you can find not only this book, but a lot of great true crime books that we cover on the program. Or you can find our paranormal books and paranormal swag and gift items in our Amazon shop. Denise, thank you so much for being here.
All right. Thank you for having me, Dave.
All right, let's do it. Time to kick open those case files. You know it, folks. Dumb crimes and stupid criminals up next.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, dumb crime, stupid criminals, it is. Thank you to the listeners that have sent in some stories. Remember, if you have dumb crimes and stupid criminals in your neck of the woods, we want to hear about them. You can email those stories to us at dave@darknessradio.com. We will share them on an upcoming episode of the program. All right, Tim. Good God, what a weird world. We're going to West Jordan, okay, where a woman was arrested Friday in West Jordan after she allegedly shot a juvenile male with a bow and arrow from a rooftop and then began threatening him with firearms. Yeah, she was committed to this. Chelsea Marinos Huggins, 38, is being held on suspicion of aggravated assault and child abuse. Police responded to a home near 7800 South and 5200 West Friday afternoon to what was initially reported as a stabbing, according to West Jordan Police Sergeant Adam Julian. They encountered a juvenile male with a fairly significant wound to his leg. Hmm. In a probable cause statement, another officer wrote that the wound was on his left leg. According to a statement, the juvenile told police he was shot by a bow and arrow. Witnesses at the scene told officers a woman was on the roof of her residence when she got into a verbal argument with the juvenile. They said she had a rifle and a handgun on the roof, but was pointing them at the juvenile. A witness said she saw the juvenile get hit with something, but did not hear any gunshots. She observed the juvenile bleeding from his leg and heard the woman tell him not to come back or next time she would kill him. Jeez. Huggins came out and was taken into custody without incident. How good a shot are you from a rooftop to hit somebody in the leg?
Well, okay, let me ask you this. Now, in my school, mm-hmm. we had archery as part of gym. Mm. Did you?
No, I grew up in Illinois in the suburbs where We didn't hunt our own food, Tim. We had people prepare it for us.
I did not grow up in the country, Dave. We did have archery as part of gym class.
We had things much more terrifying, much more exhilarating, like badminton.
Yeah, we had that too. I mean, badminton was the refined part of gym class.
Yes.
Of course, you also had to try and climb to the gym ceiling, which was terrifying in itself. But archery was that little part of gym class that everybody was horrible at, and you couldn't hit the target if you tried. But there were a few of us that would draw back. You would knock your arrow, you would draw back, and some of us would just wham, hit the middle of it. And those were the gods of gym class for one day. The rest of everybody else would not even get close to the target if they tried. Some of them couldn't even get it out of the damn bow if they tried. And mind you, it was just, what's that?
But yet, Willamette Tell here, she just hits a kid in the leg from a rooftop a block away.
Right. Now I'm going to credit television for this, because television and movies, because you have Hawkeye and the Avengers, and you've got the Arrow series for bringing that all back.
How about Dukes of Hazzard? Maybe she grew up as a Dukes fan.
Well, you're kind of dating yourself there.
Remember, kid, they had those exploding arrows? How the hell did the Duke boys not go to jail just for blowing stuff up?
Well, they would have. They would have gone away. I mean, the ATF would have surrounded the house if it were today. Yeah. The minute the first exploding arrow would have gone up.
Sheesh.
You know, you would have had the ATF surrounding them. And then, of course, you would have had it all on television. And the Duke boys would have gone up for about 25 years.
They're always looking for a way to get them, Duke boys. How about the fact that they're shooting exploding arrows at the police?
Well, the feds would have been there the first time an exploding arrow went up in Hazard County. I mean, that's
well,
reality.
Not the feds. You know, a lot of the southern counties don't want them revenuers.
Oh, no.
The feds coming on in.
The feds would have shown. I mean, let's face it. If Dukes of Hazzard takes place in 2020 and an exploding arrow shows up in Hazzard County, I don't care if Hazzard County's in the middle of southern Alabama. The minute that first exploding arrow goes up, the ATF shows up along with SWAT and everybody else, and maybe even the National Guard and everybody and their mother. And they take the Unabomber and his exploding arrow.
Well, the Duke boys are always outrunning the cops. I mean, as soon as you take off in a fleeing motion, that's enough to get you put away.
Well, that's a RICO charge, Dave. The minute you try to get across state lines.
Yeah. Well, they did. They always stayed in Hazzard County.
Well, then they're smart, because the minute they try to flee across, oh, let's say to Florida.
They were smart. The cops, not so much, because they knew where they were heading. They were always heading home to Uncle Jesse.
Yeah, they weren't very smart.
Or as I like to call him, Shepherd. Shepherd of Lost Sheep. Shepherd of Lost Sheep.
Yeah.
Yeah. That show was infuriating when it came to the law, but whatever. It just shows you, you know, Boss Hogg wasn't really about arresting people.
Yeah.
He was just about running the county.
So, you know, that's why, you know, in Arrow, they, for example, Arrow
talking about Arrow. Oh, okay.
Right. Arrow doesn't have like the trick arrow, like the boxing glove arrow or the
net arrow he ends up using in the exploding arrows later on in the series.
Right.
You know,
later on in the series.
When he's broke, which makes no sense.
Yeah, that didn't make
sense.
Then
he's got the good ones. So.
Yeah. But you know, you don't see like the boxing glove arrow or the big time stuff, you know. But
how embarrassing would that be to I got knocked out by what? A boxing club arrow.
Yeah, you should see that one coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, here you go, Tim. Palmer police make a pantsless pot arrest of Florida man. I know it's hard to believe something like this would take place in the great state of Florida, but it's true, Tim.
There's only one place to hide your weed, Dave, when you don't have your pants on.
Oof, good God, your prison purse?
Yes.
Palmer Township police said they charged a half-naked Florida man in Riverview Park last weekend for pot possession. About 1:30 a.m. Saturday, Township Police on patrol drove through the park at 1398 Lehigh Drive and found a car in the parking lot. According to the criminal complaint, police said the park is closed from dusk till dawn. As the officers pulled behind the early morning visitor, the car, complete with tinted windows, started backing out of the parking spot. Police turned on the emergency lights, but the car kept backing up, prompting the officers to get out of their vehicle, according to court records. The driver, identified as Rashawn A. Dunbar, partially rolled down his window and stopped the car. Police said the driver appeared nervous and fidgety, and one of the officers allegedly smelled the devil's lettuce on him, Tim.
Oh, yeah.
Lucifer's cabbage, if you will.
Lucifer's cabbage.
Police took the partially nude Dunbar into investigative detention. The 23-year-old was allegedly pantsless. Because who wants to wear pants when you're getting high?
Well, you don't. I mean, you know, because you're going to eat a little bit after you smoke. And, of course, it's going to be like Thanksgiving, and you don't want anything to cinch your waistband. So,
Yeah, there's that. I was just thinking you don't want to drip all over your pants because you don't think twice when you're eating, when you're high. I've been told, Tim. I've been told.
Well, that's the rumor.
Mm-hmm. Police also identified his backseat passenger. Court records do not specify why Dunbar was missing his pants. Search of the vehicle allegedly turned up three baggies of suspected marijuana, and a records check showed his license plate was, in fact, suspended in the great state of Florida. Ah. Police charged Dunbar of St. Petersburg with a single misdemeanor count of marijuana possession. District Judge Nicholas Engelson arraigned him a few hours later, and he was released from custody after Dunbar's passenger posted his $1 bail.
$1?
That's what it says here. That can't be right. Maybe because he didn't have his pants. They're like, yeah, you can get out. I just need a dollar. Do you have that handy?
Now, what would you do if you're a cop and you go, okay, you can get out. You just need a dollar. And then you start laughing. And all of a sudden, he just reaches behind him, spreads the old cheeks, and goes, I got it right here.
What if he just started coughing out quarters? Right out of the old shooter.
And goes, here, I just need to cough four times and you can have it.
Here's a nightmarish story, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
A nightmarish story on many levels. Not really a dumb crime, but it's a terrifying legality thing going on.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yep.
A man who fell into a rat-infested nest when a sinkhole collapsed on a New York sidewalk is suing the city and a building landlord over the horrific fall. Leonard Shoulders, 33, was waiting for a bus, Tim. He goes past by all the time. He was waiting for a bus at East 183rd Street and 3rd Avenue in the Bronx when the sidewalk collapsed beneath his feet in late October. Surveillance shows video the moment Shoulders fell more than a dozen feet into the hole as he desperately tries to hold onto the concrete but continues to slip further underground. Passersby rush to Shoulders' aid only to find the man has been swallowed entirely by the sidewalk. Some call out asking him to wave his hand or yell if he's okay. However, Shoulders' mother, Cindy White, said the pit was so full of rats that her son was unable to scream for help, too terrified that the rodents would crawl into his mouth. He was like, Ma, the rats down there were ridiculous. He was like, they were like so big. He was scared to yell out because he thought they were going to go in his mouth, White told NBC4 News, describing the fall. White said he went down feet first. He was just standing and the sidewalk just was like suction, like a sinkhole, straight down. He's traumatized. He said he went straight down and he was just falling, but the debris was falling and hitting him in the head.
Oh.
It took police and firefighters a half an hour to carefully pull Shoulders out from the hole. Meanwhile, he's being covered in what he claimed were rats the size of puppies.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God. His brother, Greg White, said the concrete from the fall scraped off Leonard's skin and left his arms and leg broken and numb. There's one out of a million chance of this happening. I was shocked. I was surprised, he told the CBS New York News. Shoulders suffered a spinal fracture from the fall. He also was immediately taken to the hospital immediately. Well written.
Good.
But was
good
not.
Yep.
Yeah. He was not able to regain feeling in his legs, hands, and arms until 1 month after the ordeal. His attorney, Nick Bagley, has since filed a lawsuit against the landlord of the building and the city. He was immediately surrounded by rats, he described, the size of puppies. Bagley told CBS New Yorkers two great fears, falling through sidewalks and rats. Bagley said his 33-year-old client would be left with injuries he sustained in the fall for the rest of his life. We feel the landlord of the building and the city, both are responsible for the maintenance of that sidewalk, which was in disarray and disrepair for many, many years, he added. Police said the fall occurred because a layer of sidewalk concrete just gave out, as reported by CBS New York. Building inspectors have reportedly since deemed the area beneath the sidewalk to be in disrepair. The Department of Buildings area said that the area beneath the sidewalk was in disrepair, specifically the area over the building's cellar, which is what gave out. So there are rats in this guy's cellar the size of puppies.
Oh, my God.
A full vacate order has been given for the five-story building and ordered its owner to bring or build a green fencing around the area. Potential enforcement actions are pending. The results of that investigation, the Departments of Buildings said the full vacate order is still in effect and a construction fence has been erected around the building for public safety. The investigation is said to be ongoing while the DOB ascertains whether they were construction code violations. A sidewalk violation was reportedly issued by the Transportation Department years ago, but the department said it was ultimately the property owner's responsibility to maintain that sidewalk. Three businesses remain closed until further notice. White said her son is still traumatized and wants to know what caused the sidewalk to open up and swallow her son. Karma? I don't know.
Oh my God. You know,
can you imagine that? Just first of all, how terrifying would it be to be like standing there and all of a sudden just the ground gives way and you're sucked in?
Yeah, that alone is enough to traumatize you for life. But then,
and then when you hit, puppy sized rats begin pouring out and crawling over you.
Now, it doesn't say in the story, but did he sustain any bites? I mean,
I didn't say. Oh, God.
Yeah. Okay. And then
Then you can't yell help because if you open your mouth, the rats might try to dive in.
You know, okay. All right. You know, I've always had this fascination with New York, and I've been there a few times. Okay. And it's a beautiful city. And this is one of those stories that, you know, when you've been there and I've been to the Bronx. Okay. And you always wonder when you go to the Bronx, especially like when you go to a Yankee game, right? And I remember in particular, I remember going to a Yankee game. I'll tell you a quick story here. Going to a Yankee game, when we're on our way there, there's a body under a sheet, okay? Come to find out, that body under a sheet on the way there is my stepsister's friend. Okay. Irony of all ironies. Yeah. Yeah. So got the willies finding that out, found that out the next day. Okay. Cause stepsister calls Pop, says, Pop, I'm really bummed out. Turns out that this friend of hers, he ended up getting shot, and we saw his body on the way to the game. Okay. Just bizarre. I mean, this was years and years ago. Almost two decades ago now. That was freaky. Okay. But keep in mind, the body was under a sheet just laying out waiting for police to get there. I mean, the body was just out on the street. Somebody had just put a sheet over his body. And they were waiting for the cops to get there. And we were just walking on the way to the game. Okay. Like nobody had got there yet. Type of deal. Okay. So there's like normal horrors that you would go, you know, pardon my language. You'd go, God damn, man. You know, and you'd think of stuff like this, like architecturally, one of the most gorgeous cities in the world. You know, you could fly over in a helicopter and go, God, this is just gorgeous. What a gorgeous city. But the minute you start walking through it, you go, wow, this is like Escape from New York stuff. Like, you're like, oh, this is just horrible. How do people live in an existence like this?
I've always had good experiences when I've been in New York and walking around in Times Square. I'm glad Shane had never been there. We got to do that this year. When we were filming the Holzer Files, and it was before COVID went completely ballistic, and right, just to see the lights and the people and everything, it is amazing.
But see, they'll tell you, and people who live in New York, like in different parts of New York, will tell you Times Square is Disneyland compared to the rest of New York. You know, like that's like the touristy part of New York. That's for show. That's the show part of New York. You know, you go, I mean, if you go, like, for example, you know, like I've got relatives up in the Bronx, so that's the reason I was up in the Bronx. But when I walk around up in the Bronx, they think I'm an undercover cop, you know, because there's not really many people that look like me up in the Bronx, you know. So I walk around in the Bronx and they go, who's the cop? You know, I mean, stuff like that. But
you should stop wearing your male stripper cop costume.
I should. At the time I'm wearing like a shirt and jeans and shoes. And I get asked, well, who's the cop that's with you? When I was walking around with my stepdad, you know, and he would laugh and go, that's not a cop. That's my stepson. They're like, that ain't your stepson. That's gotta be a cop.
Why? Because you were wearing pants and shoes.
No, I know, right? It's stupid.
What does that say about the people out there?
Well, no, I mean, they're very mistrusting. I mean, in the area that we were in, I mean, up around in the 200s in the Bronx, we were near a handball court. You know, you just didn't see, I'm trying to think of a delicate way to put this. I'll just come out and say it. You didn't see very many white people in this neighborhood.
Gotcha.
Okay. So
you were definitely looking copy that way.
Yes. So you see a white person walking around in this particular neighborhood, had to be an undercover cop. So so that's just kind of where the area I was in at the time. But around Yankee Stadium, of course you saw white people around Yankee Stadium because it's the Yankees, you know, it's the Yankees. A lot of people go up that way. But they only get off of the train right at Yankee Stadium and come back off of the train and on the train because it pulls right up to the stadium. You don't generally, you know, drive your car up to the stadium like you do most stadiums in the country. You take the train up to the stadium, right to the stadium, and then you get off, you know. And then you take the train, you know, right back to where you're going. You don't generally drive to.
I'll just stay here in Minnesota where it's safe.
Well,
is it?
But see, I'm taking the long way to the point of my story. The point of my story is this: it's a wonderful exterior. New York is a magical exterior, but it has this rotting underbelly, just like the story. Like you take steps on it. It's like Disneyland. You walk around Disneyland, but you take a wrong step and it crumbles. And there's this horror show underneath, like this, where you're afraid you take a wrong step and there's rats everywhere. You know, I don't know. In the time that I spent in New York, I would see, you know, you're talking about rats the size of puppies and people go, no way. I saw a rat that was, it looked like it was the size of my arm. And I was absolutely horrified. And it had a long slice of pizza in its mouth.
Oh, God.
And
at least it knows the best way to go.
Right. I mean, New York pizza is some of the best pizza in the world, but I'm looking at it and I was just astonished. I thought, is that a beaver running across the street? And Pop laughed at me. He goes, that's a rat. And I went, a rat? And it had to have had a tail that was, you know, as long as my other arm. And I went, that's a rat? And he went, yeah, that's a rat. That's like a normal size rat. And I'm like, that's not a normal rat. A rat would be like, you know, 6 inches long. That's not a rat. That's a goddamn beaver. That's not a rat. And he goes, no, son, that's a rat. I mean, when you grow up in New York, that's a rat. You expect rats to be huge. And I was like, get me out of here. You know, did that thing grow up near a nuclear power plant?
Well, get you out of there. Maybe you should head to Pasadena, Tim, for a case of swift justice. Holy crap. First of all, New York. All right. I have no interest in going back now. Falling into open ground and surrounded by that many rats. Probably alligators in the gutter system, too, I've been told. But a man broke into a South Pasadena home and attacked his estranged girlfriend. He then died after he was stabbed and beaten by the woman's mother and sister Saturday morning. The man threw a large concrete paver through the front window of a home in the 500 block of Five Oaks Drive in Pasadena, stepped inside and began choking the woman and punching her in the face, said the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Lieutenant Barry Hall. The woman's mother and sister came to her aid, stabbing the man with a kitchen knife, beating him with a golf club. They tried to pull him off, and it didn't work. He was too strong, Hall said, so they had to resort to using weapons. South Pasadena officers responded to a report of domestic violence, entered through the shattered window, and found the man, who was pronounced dead at the scene. The woman, 37, was taken to the hospital, treated for injuries to her face, and released. Her mother and sister are not facing charges, according to authorities. They were well within their right to act in defense of their sister and daughter, Hall said. That's from the Los Angeles Times, and that is a case of swift justice. Swift justice! Swift justice! Yikes. Folks, think about it. Before you do something stupid, just think. You better think. Think about what you're going to do to her. How do you like that? Mom and sister just unleash holy hell on this guy.
Well, you know, if you got it coming.
here's a dumb crime for you out of South Carolina, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
An accused porch pirate has been arrested after wearing the exact same shirt the very next day to a South Carolina courtroom that he had worn to steal packages from people's porches, according to authorities. The series of events began after a picture of a man in a green and red North Face shirt was posted on the Goose Creek resident group on Facebook by somebody claiming he'd stolen packages that had been left on porches in the neighborhood. Beware of this porch pirate, the social media post began. This was around noon in the Oaks. Notice the empty Amazon package in his hand. It is something he stole off a neighbor's porch and threw the empty package in my trash can. Dumb crook. Then stole the package off my porch, all doing this on camera, stuffing it in his backpack with whatever else he had stolen in the neighborhood. He was with a second person also on a bicycle. The police have been notified. That's what the original posting said. However, in an announcement posted on Facebook by the Goose Creek Police Department, authorities confirmed that the man had been arrested after appearing in courtroom the very next day, still wearing the same outfit he had been pictured in while stealing items off of residents' porches. Remember seeing the post on the left? The Goose Creek Police Department asked in the social media. Well, sometimes people actually do make our job a little bit easier. This guy decided to come into our courtroom the day after the first post was made, and lucky for us, he was still wearing the same outfit. We're happy to say he is now in custody. That's our second case, Tim, of swift justice. Swift justice. Swift justice.
I hate porch pirates.
Oh, I know, they're the worst.
My hatred of porch pirates goes beyond. That's a case where the punishment should go 10 times beyond the crime. I believe that you should be able to shoot porch pirates on sight. Is that too extreme?
I'm pausing for that thought. It might be. You know,
not fatally, just like maybe in the leg.
Just in the leg with an arrow from a rooftop?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, but like hurt him real bad.
Yeah.
Like, you ever heard the joke that Dave Chappelle tells about buckshot, buckshot, birdshot, buckshot?
No.
In the guy breaking into his house?
No.
Okay, well, it's you'll have to look it up on his Netflix special, but he lives on a farm in Ohio, and basically when he goes to buy a gun at Walmart, he goes to buy a rifle. And he's like, you know, I'm a black guy in Ohio. I don't know anything about buying a gun. And he says the guy at Walmart, he puts one box up that's got, you know, a bird on it and one that's got a buck on it, you know, a deer on it. And he goes, well, what's the difference between the bullets? He said, this one is a bird shot. He said, this one would just pepper up a man's face real good, just sting a little bit. He goes, okay. And he goes, this one's buckshot. This one will blow a hole in a man real wide. He said, here's what you do. He said, when you got an intruder, he says, you load up your rifle. And he said, you put in birdshot. And you put in another round of birdshot because it'll hold six slugs, okay, in a rifle. So it's birdshot, birdshot, buckshot, birdshot, buckshot.
Jeez.
And then, yeah. So there's a sequence in which you load up your rifle because you can hold six. So it's birdshot, birdshot. So, and he explains how you see how you load up your rifle. And then, you know, that sequence in a rap song where you hear buck, buck? Well, buck, buck is the last two sequences in a rifle in order to kill a man. So it's buck, buck. It's, of course, the end of a rifle. So that's the end of your deal. So he had a meth. They have a lot of meth heads in Ohio. He had a meth head break into his house and try to steal his change jar. So he actually was two meth heads and he has a change jar right near his door, his front door. So he ended up having to use his gun. And so he tells the joke, and you can see the joke on Netflix, but it's actually kind of a funny joke because he's talking about peppering somebody who's on meth with the bird shot. But it's what's that?
I was going to say, you must be psychic because our next story has to do with Dave Chappelle.
Does it? Okay.
Yes, it really does.
Okay.
Are you ready for this?
Ready.
It takes place in Florida, too. After punching a cab driver in the face early yesterday, an intoxicated Florida man jumped out of the taxi and began dancing the street and screaming, "I'm Rick James, bitch!" Police report, according to an arrest affidavit, Paul Kijik, 50, exited a St. Petersburg bar around 4:15 a.m. He was committed to that night of partying and was kept from driving by multiple witnesses due to his level of intoxication. When police subsequently arrived at the back bar, they called for a taxi, which Kijik entered. However, Kijik, seen at the right in this photograph, began yelling at the driver and then allegedly punched him in the face as the car pulled out of the parking lot. Kijik, cops say, then jumped out of the vehicle and began dancing in the street. He screamed obscenities to include, "You white mother effers," and "I'm Rick James, bitch!" Now, I do want to point out that Mr. Kijik,
yeah,
is a white mother effer.
Well, you know, yeah, when in Rome, call them what they are.
Yeah. 300 pounds and lived less than 2 miles from the bar. And he was arrested for battery and disorderly intoxication, both misdemeanors. He was not cited for what was surely a terrible Dave Chappelle imitation. Kijik was released from the county jail Sunday morning after posting how much public intoxication, punching a cab driver in the face, and then dancing in the streets while screaming, "You white mother effers, and I'm Rick James, bitch." How much did he have to pay to get out?
I'm going to go $5,000.
$600.
That's it?
I'm Rick James, bitch. Now, what he's supposed to have done is punch the guy in the face and said, "Unity."
That's right. He's supposed to wear the ring, the Unity ring. Yep.
Unity. Yeah. What a knucklehead. Speaking of knuckleheads, let's go to college, Tim.
Can I get one more Dave Chappelle note for you to add to that story?
Okay.
If that guy was a true Dave Chappelle fan, he would have seen the video that Dave has posted within the last week that says, "If you're truly a fan of mine, you will now boycott the Dave Chappelle show or Chappelle show in general until CBS Viacom pays him for a Chappelle show." As it turns out now, Dave, here's the deal. Chappelle's show has now been sold to three different streaming outlets. Now, check this out. Not only is HBO Max, who, by the way, HBO initially, when Dave Chappelle went to pitch Chappelle's show to different places, including Comedy Central, who eventually picked up Chappelle's show, he pitched it to HBO, okay? And HBO said, "Well, what do we need you for?" That was their line to him. When he said, "Would you buy my show? You know, would you pick up my show?" Because he thought Chappelle's show would be a great place to land because they had Def Comedy Jam at one time. And he was huge on Def Comedy Jam. And they said, "Well, what do we need you for?" Because they had Def Comedy Jam. So HBO Max bought Chappelle's show to stream from CBS Viacom. There was another streaming service that's airing Chappelle show, and of course it's airing on Comedy Central, and then Netflix picked it up. Now Netflix, of course, is also hired Dave Chappelle. They have him under contract to do comedy specials. Well, when Dave Chappelle found out that they also bought Chappelle show to stream, he called up the head of Netflix and said, "You know what? I'm not feeling good about this because technically you're airing stolen or fenced goods because Comedy Central never paid me for that after they initially, you know, after they initially paid my contract. Because what happened was when he walked off the show because of creative differences, they terminated his contract. So he never made that full $50 million. Okay. So technically, they're airing stolen or fenced goods. So the head of Netflix, and this is how cool Netflix is. The head of Netflix went, okay. So they stopped airing or streaming Chappelle's show, and they gave it back to CBS Viacom and said, no, we're not interested. Took it off the network. So now what Dave Chappelle is saying is, if you support me as an artist, boycott Chappelle's show. Stop watching it. And tell these other networks, if you support Dave Chappelle, pay Dave Chappelle. And pay him a piece of residuals for Chappelle's show.
Jeez. Hey, you hate to see celebrities. Well, you hate to see anybody get screwed out of money. Like George Romero was gypped out of so much money with his Night of the Living Dead movie. And you just watch how some celebrities just, you know, make money hand over fist. Others that busted their ass and their hump on stuff get nothing.
Well, it's just a matter of being paid fairly for your work. So, right. You know, he was the creative mind behind it. He was the guy who came up with, you know, just pay him fairly for it. That's all.
Yep.
You know, you're going to re-air it, then pay him fairly for it. Let him get residuals for it. That's all. Yeah.
All right, we're at our final two stories, and it looks like Florida and California are our two final stories, Tim. Where do you want to go? Do you want to start in California and end in Florida? Do you want to go to Florida and then jump back? What do you want to do?
Let's go California, then Florida. Florida always pays off, Dave.
Oh, it does. A California man who was profiled as too friendly while attempting to re-enter the country by foot from Mexico was arrested when a border agent searched him and discovered packages of methamphetamine taped to his body, according to court records. Jerry Holwaddle, 58, sought to enter the U.S. Saturday at around 5 a.m. via a pedestrian crossing lane. Asked if he was bringing anything into the country, Holwaddle, who lives outside San Diego, replied, none. But when a Customs and Border Protection officer noticed Holwaddle was acting too friendly and wearing a loose leather jacket, he was subjected to a search that located a hard package. You're going to be felt up and they're going to find a hard package, Tim? Are you worried about that when you cross over the border?
Well, not always, but yeah.
Agents subsequently discovered four packages taped to Holwaddle's lower back and sides. The packages, which weighed a combined 2.65 pounds, field tested positive for the characteristics of methamphetamine. Holwaddle was arrested on a felony drug importation charge and booked into San Diego's Metropolitan Correctional Center, where he remains in custody in advance of a detention hearing set for tomorrow in U.S. District Court. Sadly, prosecution filings do not detail how Holwaddle's alleged excessive friendliness manifested itself. It seems likely that he would have also been searched if agents thought him to be too hostile. Perhaps adopting an attitudinal middle ground facilitates the smuggling of narcotics into the country. So don't be friendly and don't be a douche, and you might get your drugs in. Reminds me, my dad, I think I've mentioned this before, my dad and mom are going over into Canada, right?
Mm-hmm.
And or coming back from Canada. And my dad is kind of hard of hearing, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sweet, sweet guy. Very friendly guy.
Oh, yeah.
And he comes pulling up to the customs border. And they say, do you have any illegal drugs or weapons? And my dad goes, yep, okay. And the border guard just goes, what? My mom goes, shut up, dumbass. She looks at him. She goes, please ignore him. He's deaf as a doorknob. He didn't even hear what you said. My dad goes, what? Why? What did I say? She looks at him. She goes, he asked if you have drugs or weapons. And he goes, oh, no. Boy, if that doesn't make you look even more guilty, the border agent just laughed and let my senile dad cross in.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, my dad, do you have any guns and weapons? Yep, sure do. Thank you. What the hell? All right, our final story. We go to Florida, where, as you guessed it, Tim, this one pays off. After being placed in shackles due to some alleged drunken dumbassery, a Florida collegian told police that being restrained gets him off and then asked the police to do what to him, Tim? What do you think after admitting to the cops that he enjoyed being shackled. It gets him off. What do you think he asked the police to do?
I'm guessing touch him lightly or rub him a little bit.
It's a good one. Nope. He said, hey, hey, pinch my nipples.
Oh, God, no, no.
To the arrest report.
No.
Cops allege that Joseph Lancaster, a 22-year-old University of South Florida student, caused a disturbance early Sunday after refusing to pay an $820 bill at a St. Petersburg night spot. After Lancaster argued with security guards, his friends stepped in and paid the bar tab. Lancaster, stumbling and slurring his words, then began shouting, I'm sorry, none of you graduated high school, but fuck you. Upon being detained by police, Lancaster's belligerence did not cease. Fuck you, pussy. And bro, this is fucked up, he shouted, cops noted. When a police transport van arrived, Lancaster even argued with the van driver. The report states the defendant had to be placed in shackles and stated, hey, this gets me off. Why don't you reach back here and pinch my nipples?
Oh, God, no.
Charged with disorderly intoxication, a misdemeanor, Lancaster was booked into the county jail from which he was released the morning after. Okay, Tim. So, skips out on an $820 bill, is on drunk, belligerent, hassling the cops, cursing at the cops, gets arrested, shackled, and then asks the cops to inappropriately touch him. He is a white Floridian collegiate student. What is his bond?
I'm going to go 2,500.
Let's see. Try again, Tim.
It's not 25.
White collegiate student.
White collegiate student.
White collegiate student. Disorderly, drunken, refusing to pay a bar tab, lipping off to the cops, cursing at the cops while shackled, asking them to pinch his nipples. What is his bond?
For disorderly?
Mm-hmm.
Am I high or low? Will you tell me that much?
High.
I'm high?
High.
$500?
$100.
What?
Yeah. There is a problem with our country. That's all I got to say. There's a problem with the way we treat people in this country. White collegiate moron. Like, oh, you pussies didn't even graduate high school. Fuck y'all. Out on $100. Oh my God. What a world. Teach your kids well, folks. Teach them to be respectful and loving and kind people. That's all I'm asking. And $100 really put this aside. Now I understand. He was drunk. He didn't punch anybody. The bill was actually covered before he left the building. So I understand there's certain limiting factors to this. But hey, I kind of like being handcuffed. How about you? Reach back here. Give my nipples a little tweaky tweaky. Maybe more than $100. That's all I'm saying. Make it hurt. This moron doesn't know the word pain when it comes to money.
Yeah.
Well, that's it this week, folks. Thank you very much for tuning into the best in true crime talk radio. We'll be back again next week with even more shenanigans and chicanery. And remember, tomorrow, Wednesday and Friday, we will be back. Or I'm sorry, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, we'll be back with the best in paranormal talk radio, Darkness Radio. If you haven't listened to that yet, give it a free listen because you're already a subscriber and you get our archives free. That's right. Every episode without commercials, free. Go check it out for yourself and tune into the best in true crime and paranormal talk radio every week. I'm Dave, that's Tim, this is True Crime Tuesday.